Watch a patch. Night gathers, and now our podcast begins. It shall not end until we're done talking. We are
the princes that were promised.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the princes that were promised, the wardens of Long Island, the watchers on the couch, and we are, well, it's a shortened season. We're not quite at the halfway point, but we're almost there. A couple more weeks and we'll be beyond the halfway point.
Right.
Have you noticed a difference in pacing already? Yes. With these two episodes?
Definitely in the second episode, I noticed there were like ravens sent, and like in the same episode, people are getting those ravens.
Yeah.
John's getting the raven from Danny in that episode. It's not being held off until like a week later or 2 weeks later. It's right there. You know, yeah. Sam is saying, you know, a raven. John's getting it.
Like the next scene.
All at once. Like, boom, raven sent, raven received.
I was talking to Carolyn, and she said something interesting, and I think that 16 million people watching Dragonstone overnight, 9 point something watching it live, or 10, what was it, 10.1, I think, watching it live, and then 6 million more on DVR or replay that first night. You talk about 16 million people watching one show. And what Carolyn said to me was the earlier seasons, 1, 2, 3, 4, even 5, there are so many characters.
A lot of people can't keep up with the characters. That's right. The big thing. You know, it's like, oh my God, there's, I don't know who this is. I don't know who these characters are. Now all of a sudden it's like, you know,
she knows every character this season.
Now or something, wherever it is.
She knows every single character this season. There's not one character that she had a question about, the Sand Snakes, Ilaria Sand. That's about as deep as you get into B-level characters. And she knows them. You know every single character in the season. So it works so much better. For guys like me and you, of course we can enjoy the other seasons. We know all of the characters, but we have a background in the source material. For your average HBO viewer who's only watching these episodes once a year when they air, it is hard to keep up with all these characters. Now in season 7, you know every single one of them. You know what their history is. You know what the storyline is. You got no question about anything. You're just enjoying the show. 2 episodes in, as far as how far storylines have progressed, I feel like we're already at episode 4 or 5 of season 6. Do you understand my comparison?
Right.
As though they're at episode 4 or 5 of a 10-episode season, going into episode 3. And even that episode 1 that felt like it was a lot of catching up and a lot of setup, it was a lot more than the seasons past. The 7-pointed star, the 7 observations or performances or scenes or thoughts that we had about season 7, episode 2, Stormborn. We're going to go a little bit more in depth. We feel that these are the 7 ideas or 7 parts that either make this episode a success or a failure. Stormborn was a success. So the first topic that we wanted to discuss was Lord Varys, the Master of Whispers at King Robert's small council, and King Aerys the Mad, his small council. Now it seems he's Master of Whispers for Queen Daenerys.
Without the whispers.
Without the whispers, without the little birds. Although he has proven himself useful to her. Just off the top of my head, he achieved the alliance with Highgarden and the alliance with Dorne, which really was key for Daenerys. It may seem as though she's lost at least the Dornish alliance. That was a big win for her, and Varys really secured that. He brought Tyrion over to her, in a sense. But what else did he do? What is his function for Queen Daenerys? Especially if he doesn't have his little birds, if he's not at King's Landing with all the systems that he put in place. Instead, you have Qyburn there using Varys systems and getting a lot of information with little birds, people that Varys put in place with a system that he designed at King's Landing. So what is Varys then? Is advisor, a counselor?
Well, the only thing that could be the end game with this is if Varys, when they go to King's Landing, if and when, the little birds will turn on Qyburn because they'll still listen to Varys.
Okay.
That would be the only thing I can think of that would be a trump card, so to speak. One of the main reasons why that battle scene happened and then they got ambushed was because of Varys not being in the know.
And how can he be in the know? He's been in Westeros this whole time. We know that he left King's Landing because he felt that Tyrion's escape would point back to him. He didn't trust Jaime Lannister enough to not blame the escape on him. So he decided it was a good idea for himself to travel to Essos with Tyrion. And this is a big difference from the books, as Varys does leave King's Landing, but it doesn't seem like he leaves Westeros in A Song of Ice and Fire. And then he is there at the end of A Dance with Dragons.
He leaves, but it's like he fetches another boat and he comes right back in the King's Landing, you know, like on this, you know. But not noticed.
Like he pulls a Sir Barristan when he got kicked off the Kingsguard, and then they try to take him. He sneaks out, and then he sneaks back in with a shawl and ratty hair, and nobody knows, nobody thinks that Barristan Selmy would dress like that. And we know Varys is a master actor; he plays many parts, so he can dress up in some costume and move around unnoticed. But this Varys in Game of Thrones, he's really hard for me to read.
Do you think that he's going to do a turn on Dany?
The only reason I don't think so is because of how much time is left in the series.
Right, exactly.
But that being said, we know the character he's based off of, whose ring his hat is in, the character he's based off of, and we know it's not really Dany. It, you know, it's Aegon John Connington, right? But they're not included.
Did you think that when HBO was doing the first season, when they had that scene with Varys and Illyrio Malpaitis,
right,
they were thinking at the time of season one back 2000, whenever they started writing and filming 2009, 2010, whatever it was, they would eventually bring in the Fagin storyline, but then realize that, you know what, it's just not, it's going to be too much. We're not going to do it. And that's why kind of like Illyrio Malpaitis is a guy we see, we don't see him. When was the last time we saw him?
I don't think we even saw him in season five, bro. I think the last time we saw him was like the King's Road episode. Or whatever episode that Dany got married to Drogo.
He wasn't even in with Varys when Tyrion first got there, right?
Right. I believe Varys mentions him and says, "Oh, this is my good friend Illyrio Malpaitis' manse. He helps to rule the city, so he's away." And then they just forget about it. They forget about that character, kind of playing it off as though they're just old friends and Varys is supporting Daenerys, so Illyrio is helping him however he can. But it does kind of contradict itself because the danger that Illyrio Malpaitis has put himself in season one, which we don't realize in season one, but looking back we see, especially if Illyrio Malpaitis doesn't have a real investment in who wins the Iron Throne. For him to be backing the last Targaryens, who the King of Westeros once dead and has sent assassins after, for him to be housing them, protecting them, and arranging a marriage between the young princess of Dragonstone and this great Khal of the Dothraki, I'm not going to say it's dangerous, but it's not a position or a responsibility that somebody wants if they don't have an investment in the outcome of that marriage and an invasion of Westeros and whatever the end goal is of that marriage alliance between the Dothraki and the Targaryens. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to say that he did that just as a favor to Varys, all right, well, I need some explanation of their relationship then, because that's a big favor to do so for somebody. And that was one of my questions, is where is Illyrio Malpaitis in all this? If he wasn't going to play a part in the end, which I can understand why. But it's like setting up one thing and then answering it with another is really not the biggest deal. It's not.
They think at first they're going to put in young Griffin, John Connor. They got the season two and season three and where the story was going.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that. And it's like you had like this storyline that they left open so they could do it.
Right.
That it's not there anymore because they're not doing it. And now it's just like a forgotten about storyline.
You might be right. We said that season five was a cutoff where we knew that the Aegon Targaryen, John Connington redemption storyline, Griff, young Griff, we knew that wouldn't be included in season five. Once Tyrion got taken by Jorah Mormont, we knew that that was the case. When Varys first talked to Tyrion and told him that he supports Daenerys, we knew that Aegon had no place in this. Which is disappointing. I don't really think he's Aegon Targaryen. It is a very enjoyable storyline, especially Tyrion traveling with him and that crew on the on the Roine River. And I understand why it's cut out, but cutting that out completely changes your Varys and your Illyrio. Were they supporting Daenerys from day one? Obviously not. They must have been supporting Viserys. But Viserys is a fucking moron, bro, and he has been since day number one. It makes me think that Varys and Illyrio are not as smart as they're made out to be for supporting a king such as Viserys. It would have been a Mad King situation.
And I love Viserys more of a character than I would ever love Robert Baratheon. But I love Viserys because he is crazy. Not because
right.
He would be a potential a good king. Or
No. Yeah, right. He's not a guy you're rooting for.
The positive one influence in the realm. It's right. More of a, he's just a nut.
He's just an entertaining character.
Right.
Because of his quirks. He wouldn't have rallied the realm around him. Varys and Illyrio would have had to have seen that. If they didn't see that, then I can't take them seriously. So all that being said now, Dany has every right to give him the third degree. So it does seem then that Varys is very much in Daenerys' corner.
Right now at this point, I would think so. As we just said, it's too late in the game, and I just think they're just trying to throw a little wrench into your thinking of what the situation is. I just don't think Varys is going to turn on her.
I would think then the scene is just to show some growth in Daenerys. Varys is exactly who he is at this point in time, and that's who he's going to be. The only disappointment I have in this is knowing what Varys is doing, because part of the lore of Lord Varys and Peter Baelish is not knowing what their plan is, but knowing that they have a plan. And if you go back to season one and their rhetoric to each other, and then I believe it was episode 10, Fire and Blood, where they have that little showdown before Joffrey enters as the new king. They say they respect each other, but they both have their own long-term plan, and you realize it.
Not now. I think they've just realized that it's not important right now.
If I don't see a Littlefinger Varys reunion of sorts or their feud come to a head, it doesn't matter to me. I'm okay. I guess it'd be kind of interesting if I did, but I don't need to see them ever meet again. I don't know that they will. I don't seriously doubt it. I don't think they will. That's about all I got on Varys, unless you have something else to say. I would think he's not going to rock the boat for the rest of this season.
The only thing else I could just really add, him not being in King's Landing, that was actually a full-blown surprise attack.
You think him not being there, that's large part of that Euron attack on Euron's fleet?
You would have known. Be wary. My birds whisper that there's going to be a Euron that's coming for them or something.
We're going to touch on that battle a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But number two, I wanted to talk a little bit about Tyrion. I came up with a lot of thoughts on Tyrion Lannister, specifically about Tyrion's relationships with other characters throughout the entire series, throughout the entire saga, since season one, since chapter one. Tyrion always seems as though he's a peacekeeper. He seems as though he puts a lot of emphasis and a lot of importance on the relationships that he forms. He's a dwarf, so he can't overpower any of the people that he meets for the most part. And he needs to rely on his wit, on his cunning, on his charisma to get what he needs. So I can go through this just off the top of my head, all of Tyrion's relationships. Jon Snow, Jeor Mormont, Yoren, Brandon Robb, Catelyn, Mord, Bronn, the Mountain Clans. You go through all these people, even his own family, Lord Tywin, Cersei. He knows how to play into these people, or he figures out real quick how to talk with these people so that he forms a relationship that's not at odds with them, that doesn't make them an enemy, but it's a relationship in which he is able to get what he wants one way or another. Perfect example being the Mountain Clans, who come upon him to kill him and steal his stuff. No reason to keep him alive, but he's able to talk his way out of that. Tyrion's relationships in particular was going to be really important for this end game. Starting with next week, his relationship with Jon Snow from season one, his relationship with Varys has already played an important part, where he's at right now, where Daenerys is at right now, where a lot of characters are at right now. His relationship with Dany has just found its stride, I think, where she names him Hand at the end of season six, after he proves himself to her. His relationship with Littlefinger, I didn't even think of until you mentioned it, that should surely come into play again this season. Mm-hmm. His relationship with Sansa may come into play again. And then, of course, his relationship with Cersei and with Jaime may come into play again. And Cersei is really the only character who he does not have a good relationship with. He doesn't have common ground. She just wants to kill him, and there's nothing that he can do to change her mind.
Change that.
And he tried. He tried very hard when he was acting Hand, even afterwards. Once she wanted Sir Mandon Moore to kill him, it was pretty much curtains for that relationship. Let's talk about Jon Snow first, because that's probably the most important relationship at this point in time. And we go back, and Jon Snow was at a very impressionable point in his life when he was spending this time with Tyrion. And at first, he dislikes Tyrion. Tyrion is brutally honest, telling Jon things that Jon does not want to hear, suggesting that Jon made a mistake in joining the Night's Watch, suggesting that the Night's Watch that Jon has so much respect for and is excited about is not what he thinks it's going to be. It's rapists, murderers who would rather stay at the wall than be executed. He breaks Jon's rose-colored glasses in seeing the Night's Watch. And when Jon realizes that the Night's Watch is a lot like what Tyrion was saying, he develops a respect for Tyrion just for telling him the truth. And from there, it seems their relationship reaches the point where they call each other friend up right on top of the wall. So what do you expect when they meet next week, Tyrion and Jon? No hug, I wouldn't think, because it's been too long.
Shake of the hand.
You think so?
Definitely. Why wouldn't they?
Well, because Tyrion is hand to Daenerys Targaryen. He's calling herself the Queen of Westeros. And she wants Jon to bend the knee to her.
Well, he's still going to shake his hand, though.
It'd be nice. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I feel like it's going to be an icy reception when Jon comes before Daenerys. And I think that Tyrion will be standing by Daenerys' side when he enters the throne room.
But there's one thing that Tyrion didn't mention that she wants him to bend the knee.
Why do you think he didn't mention that?
I think Tyrion sees the big picture and wants him to come down. He knows if he says you have to come down and bend the knee, there's a greater chance he won't come down.
Right.
So if I leave it out, maybe there's a better chance he will come down.
Sansa and Davos are expecting that he is going to have to bend the knee, but he says that he won't.
Jon won't bend the knee. Definitely not this week. Better not at the end of the season either. He's been with the Wildlings too long. He's going to be, I don't bend my knee.
Let's say he doesn't bend the knee. What is Daenerys' reaction to that?
Watching that, the preview, and we'll talk about it later when we talk about the preview, but Jon's going to come down there talking about the White Walkers. Dany's right now thinking, all she's thinking about is born to rule the Seven Kingdoms. I got 33 nicknames, working on two more. Right.
Like, I could start telling you my nicknames will be here till tomorrow. And then she'll start doing it. Do like 36 hours later.
Just got this new one, the princess that was promised. Yo! And not going to stop there.
I will not. I will not stop until I have Westeros and 125 titles.
That everyone must say when they approach me.
Yeah.
Before you say the queen, you have to at least give out 75 of those 125 titles.
The Unburnt, the Mother of Dragons, Khaleesi.
Breaker of Chains,
Mother of Dragons.
Queen of the Friend Zone.
Yeah.
I think, like, she's not going to believe Jon, but I think there's that shot. Again, we're going to talk about this later.
Yeah.
But I think she's going to be like, shit, what if this guy's right? All I've been doing is been trying to rule the Seven Kingdoms. Now I'm going into this kingdom that is seconds away, you know, moments away, days, weeks away with having this great dead army kill it.
But why would she believe him?
I don't think she will, but I think there's going to be a moment of thought. Do you believe in ghosts? You'd be like, no, but you know, tonight maybe before you go to bed, you're going to be like looking at the ceiling.
Maybe there are ghosts.
Yeah, there are ghosts. You know, like, I don't believe in it, but maybe there is.
Jon's not an idiot, so there must be a reason that
Tyrion's
he does.
Gonna come in, though. Tyrion's going to say, listen, he's...
Right.
I don't believe in either, but if he's saying it, if there's a white... You know, if he sold the army of the dead, I believe him.
All right, well, let's stick with Tyrion, because I think we've talked about this before, and it seems kind of obvious at this point that Tyrion is that link that will...
I think it's so obvious.
Get Daenerys and Jon to at least...
Says in season one. I think you should go on there. I think the whole entire process of Jon and Tyrion meeting up would be for them to join a fellowship, to join a bond. So for this time, for that these two main characters to meet, that Tyrion is going to be the glue. Even in the books. I mean, eventually Tyrion will meet Dany in the books, and Tyrion will be the common link between Jon and Dany.
You say the word balance with Jon Snow a lot. I had never thought of it until you said that. Talking about the main three, your Dany, your Jon, and your Tyrion, it seems in that relationship that Tyrion's the balance. And maybe not thematically, but just these three characters and these three characters getting on the same page and having a common goal. Tyrion is the balance that makes that happen. He begins this TV series getting to know Jon Snow. Jon Snow maturing a little bit and learning a little bit about himself and learning how to be a better man of the Night's Watch because of his relationship with Tyrion. Tyrion leaves him. All these years later, he reaches Daenerys, does the same thing for her. Now they'll come together, and Tyrion is that common link that will put them both on the same page. When they meet, I don't think White Walkers will be the first thing out of Jon's mouth, because I think that it will be some posturing. This will be the first lord that Daenerys meets in Westeros, a realm she's attempting to conquer. Jon Snow will be the first lord, king that she meets that isn't a part of her alliance. There'll be some posturing, and she is going to ask him to bend the knee. And I think it will be a hot situation that needs to be diffused, where tempers are flaring. Because these are both proud people, both who have been through a lot to get to where they are now, and both of whom have a greater mission, so to speak. Jon's mission is to save the realm from the White Walkers. Dany's mission is to save the realm from the Lannisters, the War of the Five Kings, to retake her throne. It seems like Jon's mission is a little bit more humbling, a little bit more modest than Daenerys.
She's just so selfish.
I agree with you, but she's also the Breaker of Chains, and all that jazz. Things she's done in the past have been for the good of people. This will be posturing. It's going to be Tyrion that's able to defuse the situation, able to have them find some common ground, and then begin to speak based on that common ground. The other relationships that will come into play, Cersei and Jaime, obviously, it's his brother and his sister. And Cersei, we know his relationship with her is not something that can ever be repaired. But Jaime is a very interesting relationship because they love each other. And perhaps Jaime regrets he freed Tyrion just because Tyrion killed Tywin. But do not forget that Tywin had said that Jaime was no son of his. That was some of the last words that Tywin said to Jaime, because Jaime did not want to go and be Lord of Casterly Rock. Jaime wanted to remain as Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, the best Lord Commander of the Kingsguard that he can possibly be. So Jaime was maturing and changing into what he thought was a better person, and Tywin disowned him for that change. Whereas Tywin had disowned Tyrion from day number one. So is Jaime going to be that mad at Tyrion for killing Tywin? Maybe he feels guilty, but I don't think that he'll blame Tyrion that much.
I've gotten a sense over the past season when it's been brought up a little bit, in front of Cersei, he kind of plays off the little, like, he kind of plays it off as, you know, if I see Tyrion again, I'll kill him for his father.
Do you get that vibe?
Yeah, but deep down, I don't think he would.
No, I don't think he would either. I think that it's with Cersei that he is not being himself. And I think it's getting more and more difficult for him to not be himself when he's around her. He's trying to keep safe the relationship they have because it's what he's always wanted. But I think he's figuring out now that it's not what he wants. She was at some point, but she's not anymore the only person in the world that he needs. Or maybe he's changed so much that he can't possibly have any respect for Cersei. At this point, I think that he would side with Tyrion over Cersei.
I think so too. Especially where what Cersei has done and where Cersei's leading herself to. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Cersei's going to quickly lose herself. It started with the Winds of Winter and what she did there. She seems to be holding it together. Which probably is bothering me the most this season is the way Cersei and Jaime are acting.
It just feels like it's kind of weird that it's relatively known that it was Cersei. There was like, wasn't being hidden that, you know, oh, maybe the Tyrells did it. It was the High Sparrow did it. And suicidal, you know, maniac bomber type thing.
A terror attack. Somebody blew up Deceptive Baylor.
They're not hiding the fact that it was Cersei.
She's not hiding it at all. She's not acknowledging it. She's not saying anything about it. She's just letting it sit there. That's a power move. And it makes a lot of these lords intimidated by her, but there's going to be repercussions for that, and there is going to be repercussions in her own head because of that, and Jaime as well for continuing to help her. But the relationship between Jaime and Tyrion, it's another one. They're very close, almost as close as Jaime and Cersei in a sense. I mean, obviously without the intimacy, Jaime likes Tyrion, and he's not the kind of guy that likes many people. That will come into play also. Varys, we've seen already how that's come into play for both of them. The only other relationship that I really wanted to comment on, because it will probably come into play, and you had mentioned this first, is Littlefinger. How do you think that will come into play? Do you see Tyrion and Littlefinger coming to face-to-face, or...
Not Tyrion. Littlefinger, no, definitely no way. I don't think Littlefinger is going to go back down south. I think Tyrion is going to... They're going to talk to Jon. What happened? We heard reports that, you know, the Vale army came up with Littlefinger. Don't you trust Littlefinger? Or just so you know, Jon, Littlefinger had a good hand in
your father's death. The fact that hasn't gotten out yet is amazing to me. With how spread out everyone is.
Right.
With how many people were in the throne room that day when Ned Stark was taken captive. It's amazing that not that many people know about that yet, and that Littlefinger is just walking around freely at Winterfell, of all places, having had such a big part in Ned Stark's downfall. But I'm sure he will get his. There's no love lost between Tyrion and Peter Baelish, and I think I agree with you. It will be a situation in which Tyrion tells Jon what he knows of what happened with his father being betrayed by Littlefinger. There's some more to say about Tyrion a little bit later on in the episode, but moving on to number 3 in our 7-pointed star is Melisandre of Ashai. And the inclusion of the Red Priestess last season. Remind me of her name again, John. Did it start with a K, Canerva, or?
Yeah, something like Canerva, Canera.
This is the Red Priestess that, I think it was Tyrion and Missandei, or Tyrion and Varys, they asked her to kind of hype up Daenerys. to help win over the small folk of Meereen, I believe, was the idea. The Red Priestess said that they would support Daenerys Targaryen. And I always thought that that scene was okay, but I thought it was more of a get Tyrion in this episode scene. But it seems that the inclusion of that scene last season, it helped with Melisandre this season. Because Daenerys sees her, sees that she's a Red Priestess, and she accepts her at Dragonstone pretty much unconditionally because her order was such a big help in helping Dany keep Meereen. I don't think that they were, but it seems that that was the reason for that scene last year was for Melisandre to show up here at Dragonstone without a problem. And I think I asked you this on the instant review. Having a few days to think about it, what do you think Melisandre's play is in visiting Dany? Do you think that she thinks Dany is the princess that was promised?
No.
So she's using Dany.
Well, no, not, she's not using her. But if I remember the scene correctly, when the Hani over there, Missandei, was saying in High Valyrian there is no gender. It's also the princess that was promised. She didn't back down that it was Jon. She still knows Jon is the prince that was promised. She says to Dany, you have a role to play in this. And I think the meaning of this from the Red Priestess last year was just to get to see that Dany would know about the Red Priestess, that Varys would know about these Red Priestesses. So when Melisandre comes up, connection of trying to get her and Jon together doesn't mean very important.
Okay.
I know it sounds, oh, it's too obvious. It's not good writing. Yes. Any niece and niece at this point to Jon Snow.
You've said this before, and when you say something like this, when you're that confident about it, I'm inclined to agree with you. But putting that aside for a second, would Melisandre have come to Dragonstone if she was still in Jon's good graces? Would she have suggested to Jon Snow to reach out to Daenerys?
There isn't any information that she even knew about Dany really so much.
That's what I'm saying. Like, sure. I don't think Dany was even on her radar. And it seems that her approaching Dany is really part of her play to get back in the good graces of Jon Snow, or to get close to Jon Snow once again, or to have some protection so she can speak to Jon Snow, because Jon Snow said, he said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you. That's what he said to her.
Mm-hmm. But she's still on his side. She still speaks the good graces of him. It's not like she's like, all right, I'll just forget about him.
Right. Do you think Melisandre was more loyal to Stannis, or do you think she is more loyal to Jon Snow?
I think she's more loyal to Jon Snow. I think she knew she made a mistake with Stannis. I think she sees something in Jon. She obviously doesn't know it. Just wait until, if she's still alive at this point, just wait until they find out that Jon's Rhaegar's son. I mean, she's going to be out there with, you know, with the banners flying. You know, this, she's going to be like, I told right. you, this is it. I'm right, you're wrong.
In the first episode of season 6, The Red Woman, we get the confirmation to an idea that we've had for a while. We confirm that Melisandre is way older than she is pretending to be, than she is dressing herself up to be. And it seems to me that her sorcery, her fire magic, are not so powerful that she's able to create a king. But it seems as though she believes that her faith in R'hllor can make up where her powers lack. And part of her attempt to create a champion against the White Walkers, she felt that she had to hide her age. And she needed to present herself not just as a beautiful woman, but like a voluptuous, sexified, yearned for woman. So when she removes her amulet and you see that she's really just like an old hag, it's almost like she's given up her faith in R'hllor. Or it's almost like she believes that R'hllor has forsaken her. Or she's come to the realization that she has not served R'hllor well. She's failed him. In the very next episode, in Home, she's doubting the powers she was once so confident in. She still tries to perform a spell to raise Jon Snow to wake him from death. And it seems like she fails at first. It's like her failure has come full circle and her faith is completely deflated as she leaves that room. Like, she mutters an apology to Davos and she just wanders out. It's then that Jon Snow wakes up from death, alone, well, with Ghost. And now it's like her faith is back twice as strong as it was. All because Jon Snow, she had this idea that maybe he was the prince that was promised, and she did raise him from the dead. And even though not a whole lot of emphasis has been put on that spell, or on him being raised from the dead at all, as this series winds down, what is Melisandre's function? How is she going to help Jon Snow more than she helped Stannis?
I'm coming up with an idea right now.
Okay.
I'm coming up with an idea, and call me crazy. Right now, I'm watching the scene with Dany and Mel, because someone brought up that Mel didn't have her glamour on, but you can tell, you can't really tell because her jacket is, her coat, whatever you want to call it, is over her neck, so you can't tell.
Well, she's got to have it on.
Yeah, someone thought, someone brought the idea that she didn't have it on, so why would she be like that? But you can't tell if it's on or not because she, her coat, vest, whatever you want to call it, is covering it. So about that scene, she says, only the prince that was promised can bring the dawn. Once again, bring the dawn. I am the dawn that brings the light. Lightbringer is dawn. Lightbringer is dawn. I'm telling you, I'd be dead shocked if the sword is Lightbringer. I'm sorry.
I'll believe you, because I don't have a better idea for which sword Lightbringer is. As far as it relates to Melisandre, well, as old as she is, do you think she ever really truly believed that Stannis Baratheon was the prince that was promised? And being as old as she is, she had to have known. Maester Aemon even says this. Melisandre has to know that Stannis' sword is not Lightbringer.
I think she was playing Stannis for a long time.
To what end, though?
A means to get to where she needs to be. I think what's going to happen, that Melisandre is going to be the one, after all this stuff with Dany and Jon, that I think Jon's going to start realizing some of this stuff that's happening, that's transpiring. I'm going to say that she is. I'm going to raise more of as a question.
Okay.
Will Melisandre be the one, say, this sword is special. To use it, you have to complete the Nisa Nisa part of it, Jon. And you have to kill Daenerys with it.
Oh, wow.
Is she going to be the one that says that you have to do this? This is for the realm. You have to kill her.
That's interesting. It's interesting. But it also implies that Jon will be in a frame of mind to follow through on prophecies. And that's not Jon Snow's character. Even being raised from the dead.
But everything that they see, that he sees, this maybe he has no choice but to believe in it.
Okay. Now, here's the thing with Melisandre, though. Whether she was playing Stannis or not, whether she believes in Jon Snow or not, whether she now has the power to raise people from the dead, no matter what she does, she has past sins that she has to pay for. Mm-hmm. Fictional justice, narrative justice. There's some things that people do. There's actions that they take that there's no return from. They may redeem themselves, but they're still going to be punished for that action.
Basically, like Jamie, this is one of the reasons he still has to be punished for what he did.
Yes, he does.
I guess some people will say, well, he got his hand cut off, but
that's not it.
I don't think that's it. That's why.
That changes him, and maybe it starts him down the path towards redemption, but more than likely, he has to pay for that with his life. Melisandre's case, she did worse things than Jamie. She burns people alive.
Sacrifice a kid, especially a child.
Yeah.
Been a major thing, this thing, don't harm the children.
But not only the kids, she burns lords that don't accept R'hllor. Burns them alive. Not just what that says about her character and the narrative justice that she will have to face at some point, but what does that say about the Lord of Light? About that religion? They burn people alive who do not accept. I'd have to think that she's on the extreme side of things, and that in Essos, the followers of the Lord of Light are not doing that to people that don't believe in the Lord of Light. They're not burning them alive.
The thing, like the theory of like that Bran is the Lord of Light, he is R'hllor. Do you see Bran? Is he that evil to that he's suggesting to burn children?
I don't think so, man. I don't.
Keep in mind, though, he is a Tully.
It's by like a dumb accident, just because he's not thinking about what he's doing. He wouldn't purposely burn children or tell people to burn children. But I don't think that Bran is going to end up as the Lord of Light. You know, maybe Bran is the Great Other, and it's just Melisandre's misunderstanding what she's seeing. And thinks that he's the Great Other that must not be named. But I don't think it's going to end up another time loop where he's the Lord of Light. I don't think. That theory where he ends up as Bran the Builder, I don't think that that's going to happen. You know, the Hodor time loop was interesting, but I don't think he's going to be able... who knows, man? Maybe. I don't know what his fate is, but I don't think it's that. I think these are things we should keep in mind about Melisandre, because she's going to pay for what she did.
I think she knows that, specifically now, specifically in the show.
She does seem like she's sorry. She has a tremendous sense of guilt on her. But she's still playing a game, because you just said, Dany wasn't on her radar. She doesn't think that Dany is the princess that was promised. She's just saying these things to take advantage of Dany.
She doesn't think she's the princess that was promised, but what she's seeing, I think, now is, again, this might be a plot hole. This might be the HBO just skimming through things. We don't see anything new from her, you know, any kind of vision or anything.
Right.
She has to see that Jamie has a role to play with the prince out of promise. That she has to be with Jon for some sort of reason.
Now, how can you put any faith in the visions that Melisandre has in the flame? Because it seems as though not much of what she saw was right. It was mostly misinterpreted. I might even make the argument that she doesn't see anything in the flame. We had that scene with Sandor Clegane last week where he sees something in the flame. I don't think that Melisandre, if she can read it, she can't read it very well.
She doesn't interpret it correctly yet.
Right.
But so that's why a lot of the stuff that she says, two things I want to bring up real quick. All the stuff that she saw.
You're talking about in the flame, what she saw?
Is it really about John? Then we have to go back and decode some of her lines. And one of them is that you'll betray everyone that you loved. That goes back to John.
She said this to Stannis?
She said Stannis, but it's really meant about John and not Stannis.
Okay.
And then what? Then who will John have to betray?
Okay.
Secondly, there's that line where she says to Stannis, but it fits so much in with John, and it doesn't fit in the line with Stannis at all. She says to Stannis, "You're the son of fire. You're the warrior of light. You will be king." Well, Stannis isn't the son of fire. Not literally. John is the son of fire, being Rhaegar's son.
Okay.
And he has the king's blood of being Rhaegar's son, and he has the possibility of being a king. So that's two of the three. He is a warrior. We know that. He is the warrior of light, and that's all three.
To get into the prince that was promised the last hero, Azor Ahai, whether they're all the same person, different people. To get into all that, it's a whole separate podcast. And you know, we've touched on it many times, but it's more important now than it has been at all. Because we're in the end game. And if we're going to have an Azor Ahai, his time is coming. But my point is with Melisandre, she's shady. I did not trust her with Stannis. And maybe she was using Stannis, but she doesn't act like she knew that Jon was anything, literally until she saw Jon. When Stannis' campaign against Ramsay failed, she bailed on him. Maybe she realized then that Jon was actually the prince that was promised.
Did you notice in season five, the icicle that was melting, that the snows were melting, that was a show's way of doing, of showing this, you know, all she sees is snow.
That happened
one of the first times in the show where okay. She starts to turn to John.
Yeah.
The snows are melting, that her prayer worked, blah, 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 blah.
It seems to me as though the Lord of Light, the Faith in R'hllor, this entire religion, Azor Ahai is a big part. If there is an Azor Ahai, like we think that there is, what does that say if the only religion that has faith in this final hero that will save the known world from the Long Night, if that really is a religion that burns unbelievers, that performs blood magic, that has a person like Melisandre as a figurehead. And it's interesting because you could compare Melisandre to Thoros. And he traded away Gendry for supplies. I'm sure he didn't feel good about it. But he's not burning a kid. So it may be that Melisandre's version of her faith is an extremist's version. She has her own end game, her own goals to accomplish. They may go hand in hand with saving the realm, with finding Azor Ahai, but they can be separate from it also. Basically what I'm saying is don't trust Melisandre.
I'm going to disagree. I trust her. I believe her. I think the fact that she's away from Stannis, the false king usurper, Stannis Baratheon, she's with the White King, I'm going to believe her. Now, what I'm not saying is I don't think she should not be punished. She's going to be punished for what she's done.
Yeah. And there's some things that characters do in a story that you can't come back from. You always get what's coming to you. Generally, it happens in life. But in fiction, it always happens. You always get what's coming to you. The serial killer will always get caught. There's always justice, especially in fiction. The Lannister kids. Number four, the Lannister kids. How are they doing with the keys to the realm, so to speak? So I want to touch on Tyrion's war strategy for Daenerys, as well as the beginnings of Jaime's war strategy for Cersei, and Cersei's job thus far as Queen of the Seven Kingdoms. And my main point with all of this is that each one of the Lannister kids is displaying characteristics of Tywin Lannister, because the situations they're in are all situations of leadership, important decision-making.
Funny you say that. I have to right now repeat a line that my friend texted me the other day about after the episode. He goes, I can't even say it without laughing. It's so funny. It's funny because we know our friend Joey's a bit wacky, and like so how he makes his texts are just like out of the blue, kind of. So he goes, "The military advice fails again. Never split your forces. Custer learned that the hard way."
Indian Schmindians.
The imp would lose his head if it was me.
Custer learned it the hard way. But that's Tyrion's play. I forget if it's Dany or if it's Tyrion that explains that they don't want the Unsullied and the Dothraki laying siege to King's Landing.
I think Tyrion and Jaime both agree that they don't want that.
And that's sound advice. But the main idea of their strategy is not to go and destroy King's Landing and to try and not destroy the realm any more than it already is from the War of the Five Kings, but to lay siege to King's Landing and starve Cersei and Jaime out. Now, you do hurt the people, the small folk that live at King's Landing. And knowing Cersei, she'll be the last one to surrender. She'll get all the food she can. You're not going to get her to give up. She'll starve to death in King's Landing. And I don't know if the mountain needs to eat necessarily, but I'm sure he'll start killing small folk so she can eat them.
Mountain, go to the Riverlands. Yeah. There's a kid who makes green.
Oh, yeah.
Who makes cakes.
Get me hot pie.
We can use him if we get hungry.
I actually heard he delivers.
Take the bread and him.
It is a sound strategy. No one's going to expect that Cersei would not at some point give up. I mean, Tyrion must know that she's not likely going to give up. Cersei's not someone who's going to surrender. It is the main part of their plan, the part of their plan that they feel will win them King's Landing, but it needs some supplementary movement. They can't have the Dothraki and the Unsullied laying siege because it looks like foreigners invading Westeros and will actually... that will do good for Cersei. If these foreigners lay siege to King's Landing, the capital, it would probably inspire a lot of nationalism, a lot of Westerosi pride, so to speak. It'd be anti-productive. Great point. But the Martells don't like that. Yara Greyjoy doesn't like that. Olenna Tyrell doesn't like that because it means that it's their people, their armies, that will have to lay siege to King's Landing. And part of the reason that they joined up with Dany was because of her strength, her dragons, her Unsullied, and her Dothraki. And if they're not using them to take King's Landing, then what are they using them for? And Tyrion knows that they would take issue with this because he's good at reading people. And he knows most of these people. He's had conversations with them in the past. That's just something that he does. We talked about it before. It's his greatest strength is the way he can form a relationship with somebody. But he knows that the Martells and the Tyrells in particular won't like this strategy. So he says that we're going to use the Unsullied and the Dothraki, and we're going to use it to take the most powerful castle in the realm. Maybe not at the moment, but we're going to take the seat of Cersei Lannister. We're going to take Casterly Rock. Because if we take that, yes, she's queen of the Seven Kingdoms, she sits the Iron Throne, but she lost her home castle. We know what happened to Rob when he lost his home castle. A, it just makes people lose faith in you as a monarch if you lose your castle. B, it cuts off the warden to the west. It cuts off the main power in the west. And C, it gives them, I was going to say, it gives them control over all that Lannister gold, but I recall Tywin saying something to the effect of the Lannisters were broke a few seasons ago. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. But still, Casterly Rock, Lannisport, they're known for their mines, for their gold. I'm sure that something can be figured out. The Lannisters have a pretty strong navy. Not the best, but they have a pretty strong navy. They have one of the best house armies, even though a lot of their power is at King's Landing. And it's surrounding King's Landing more. So now it's Dorne, Highgarden in the south, and Casterly Rock, Lannisport in the west. And she's already got enemies in the north. So it just increases that stranglehold on King's Landing. So it's a great strategy. It's Tywin-like in the strategy itself, but it's not very Tywin-like in the way that Tyrion explains it all to Ilaria, Olenna, and Yara, explaining it so that they don't get frustrated or angry that it's their armies that have to lay siege to King's Landing. It's like he's explaining himself to keep the peace, which is not something that I feel like Tywin would do. It's a Tywin-like plan, but Tywin isn't going to go and try to convince these women that they should stick with it. Like, what other choice do they have? They're in it with Daenerys. They can't go crawling back to Cersei. It's not like he's bending over for them. It's not like that. But he's like a little bit too concerned about their feelings. He doesn't need their approval for this plan. He just needs them to do what they're told. And that's how Tywin Lannister would look at it. But Tyrion isn't looking at it that way. In one sense, it's very Tywin-like. In another sense, it's very un-Tywin-like. What are your thoughts on Tyrion's war strategy?
I just think ever since I saw the episode, I just went to the fact that with Varys not being in the game, that is the reason why they get ambushed. What were the reasons? Let's raise this question.
Sure.
I think maybe we raised it before. Why wouldn't... Is it Yara the show? Is it Asha?
It's Yara.
What's her name? What's her name?
It's Asha Greyjoy in A Song of Ice and Fire. Okay, and it's Yara. Greyjoy in A Song of Ice and Fire. Yeah, Yara in Game of Thrones.
All right, so we're going to call her Asha Greyjoy because that's her name.
Fine. Sounds good to me, man. I love that name.
Why wouldn't she or anyone in there at that council say, listen, okay, we're here right now at Dragonstone. You're going to go back to Dorne. You know, even Tech King's Landing. Asha's uncle, Euron Greyjoy, is out and about. Should we be prepared for him? There was nothing that was like, oh, he was completely forgotten about.
I don't think that Yara forgot about him. I think she knew that she would come into conflict with him at some point. I don't think she thought so soon, but she should have given a heads up to Daenerys and to the rest of her allies. Dany and Tyrion make no mention of Euron Greyjoy. They know that he wanted to kill Yara and Theon and that he won the Seastone chair. But they don't know the extent to which Euron Greyjoy will go. And maybe Yara and Theon don't either. But it seems that when we get to that final scene, we'll really dig in. But Yara did not seem surprised. She got taken by surprise, but she did not seem surprised with what was going on.
Right, good, right. She wasn't like, oh my gosh. She kind of like...
She's like, I knew this was coming. Probably another Tywin thing. Like, he always had every angle covered.
Right, but you do look at it, I think you would think they probably thought they had would have enough men to split the armies up.
Yeah.
But I think this all comes back down to that they just didn't expect Euron Greyjoy to do what he did. I think that's what it all comes down to. I think any angle comes back to no one not realizing Euron was going to be there. Varys not knowing, Yara not expecting it to be that happening, Tyrion and Dany not expecting it, you know... Too comfortable, maybe, in their own army that, you know, oh, well, you know, look at the size of our army. Who's going to stop us?
I don't want to say that they were overly confident because they have a very well thought out plan. They didn't make a move to go to Westeros until they had the numbers they needed. By every angle, it seems like they're being careful. But Euron Greyjoy he's a wild card, not something that they expected, but they probably should have. I'm sure we'll see a scene next week to that extent when the news of this naval battle gets back to Dany and Tyrion.
Well, this is the second time Tyrion's messed up on war counseling.
Oh, with the Great Masters. I'm not going to put it on Tyrion. If anything, I'm putting it on Varys. Yeah, he's not at King's Landing, but how does he have no contact with the people at King's Landing that were giving him information? None of them were loyal enough to continue to do so after he left?
I don't know. It just, that was a lot of plot-holy stuff there, you know, in those sequence of events.
Cersei and Jaime, we talked about their scene in Stormborn addressing the Southern Lords. Cersei was very un-Tywin-like. That's not her strength, asking lords for help. She's lying. She's trying to fearmonger to get them to give her aid, to remind them of their oaths to the crown, to the Iron Throne. To remind them that she's the queen. And maybe it wasn't so much asking for their help as it was making sure they're going to stay loyal and that they're not enemies and getting a read on them. But it was a good move to call them all to King's Landing to get a read on them. But you can tell that Cersei's so uncomfortable asking them for help. It's forced.
Deep down, it's not genuine that she needs the help. She just wants to use them.
She wants to control a situation. She wants to control a lord to the point where he has to. She says, jump, and the lord says, how high? That's where Cersei's comfortable, is taking advantage of people, controlling people, using power to get what she needs. But asking her lord's bannermen to fulfill their oaths and help her protect the realm, it sounds so forced and fake. And I saw a comment somewhere saying that basically Lena Headey's done such a good job, but here in this scene, she doesn't. I disagree. I think it was good acting and I think it was good writing. I think that the character of Cersei, that's not something that she can do.
It's like, the story is in this guy in my head right now, episode of The Office where they have the picture on the paper.
Oh, the duck and the...
And they have, what's her name, the blonde?
Angela
trying to apologize to all the people.
Right.
She's just not good at it at all because she's totally not, you know,
she's like, oh, not genuine. I'm sorry if the picture offended you. And I said I was sorry. Like, she just, the way she's doing it, it's like...
You should be accepting it. This day is bananas.
Dude, that's a perfect comparison. It is like that. It's somebody doing something because they have to do it and it's not who they are. And Cersei's not a politician and she's not a leader and she doesn't inspire people. Let me take that back. She does inspire people, but not in the right ways. She's a big inspiration to Sansa, whether Sansa knows it or not, but she didn't set out to do that. It's just Sansa's. So the parts of Cersei's personality that got the job done, and it inspired her to be more like that. But otherwise, Cersei's not someone that can rally the troops, that she's not somebody that the realm will believe in and rally behind. I didn't love that part of the scene because it was somewhat uncomfortable and awkward to watch, but it probably was uncomfortable and awkward for Cersei. How is she like Tywin in this scene? She's not really. It's a good move to call the lords there to reestablish who's loyal, who's not, to make yourself seen, let people see King's Landing so that the rumors of what happened at the Sept of Baelor will maybe start to wind down. That is a Tywin move. It's wise. But Tywin would know how to talk to these lords and secure their loyalty. Cersei does not, because she does not have the politician part of Tywin. She has his scheming. Red Wedding Tywin, that's Cersei. Battle of Blackwater Tywin, that's Jaime or Tyrion. Speaking of Jaime and his conversation with Randall Tarly, I would say that this is the most Tywin-like of the three Lannister kids in this episode. We talked about this in the instant review. He plays to Randall Tarly's pride. He cuts right to the chase. Mm-hmm. He's not pretending to be super pro Cersei himself. It kind of reminded me of Tyrion's speech in the Blackwater episode before he leads all of them out to take Stannis' men in the rear, where he says, don't fight for Joffrey. Don't fight for the Iron Throne. Fight for your home, because these are your women that Stannis' men will rape. These are your houses that they'll destroy. And that's how Jaime approaches it, that kind of tone, that attitude where, I know you don't like my sister, but before your loyalty to Highgarden, your loyalty is to Westeros. And right now we have a foreign invader with dragons, with Dothraki, who have never set foot in Westeros before, with Unsullied, and they're here to take Westeros and change your life, to take your home. Are you going to let them? I'd like you to be my general. When this is over, I'll name you Warden of the South. Dude, that was textbook Tywin Lannister. Mm-hmm. And he didn't need to be cruel. He didn't need to be menacing. But we know that he can be. So good job by Jaime. Anything else to add with the three Lannister kids and their performance in Stormborn?
I guess the question would be is, which one is the Targaryen?
If one is a Targaryen.
I would love it. I would really would love it if, you know, the twins here are not Targaryen and they're all Tywin's kids.
But if you think about the character Tywin, saddest thing would be if Cersei and Jaime are the Targaryens. Mm-hmm. Tyrion's his true son. That'd be the saddest for Tywin, even though he's an asshole. Oh, I just wanted to mention real quick, with Cersei, in that uncomfortable situation, these are all men, these lords, that she's asking for help. Mm-hmm. You know, she's always had that, not exactly an equal rights or feminist point of view, but men taking advantage of her and her being a piece of property. She promised herself she'd never live like that again. So it kind of adds to her asking these lords for help, who are all men, and who are all kind of looking down on her and resenting her for what she's done. And it's just another dimension to that whole scene. I think it adds a lot. All right, number 5, the seven-pointed star. Cersei and Jon, tall tales. So we touched on this briefly. We touched on this last week, that the lords of the North that have declared Jon Snow their king, they've not seen the White Walkers, and they've not seen the army of the undead. They have seen Jon Snow in action. They've seen what he can accomplish. They believe in Jon, because he got revenge for the Red Wedding. They call him King in the North because he's a bastard, but he is a Stark. He showed the strength of the old Kings of Winter. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
So all of these things, it's like a no-brainer to make him the King in the North. So because of all this, because of what Jon has proved to these guys, they believe Jon when he starts talking about the White Walkers. You and I know that there are White Walkers, there's an army of the undead, because we're watching this narrative. But if you think about it from the point of view of these northern lords, I mean, the White Walkers are monsters from fairy tales. So for the guy you called king to tell you that, it'd be like if I told you Humpty Dumpty is coming, he's swimming across the ocean, bro, he's going to come over here and he's going to kill us. It's a fairy tale. Not a lot of people believe, even in the north, not a lot of people believe in the White Walkers. But they still follow John and they listen to him and they believe him when John says what will be required to defeat the White Walkers. And keep in mind that the Lords of the North, they're already damaged, right? Their keeps, their people, already damaged, and they're in bad shape for the coming winter. They've given up any chance at a final harvest to stand by Jon Snow as he prepares for a war against, again, from their point of view, monsters from fairy tales. Everything is going wrong for them. They're at a very, very dangerous crossroads because winter is coming and the North feels the worst of this winter.
What I'm thinking is it, and I can translate this maybe to Cersei a little bit, is it out of respect that they're believing Jon?
Yes.
They don't believe it, they're believing Jon because of Eddard.
Yeah, I think it has to do with that. I do.
And in the same sentence, the same breath, are they listening to Cersei and doing what Cersei feels because it's Tywin's daughter? Like, oh, we know what Tywin would do.
Yeah.
She's done it. She'll do it again.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. Jon Snow offers these lords the truth. He hasn't lied to them. He hasn't led them astray. He's been completely honest with them. I think everything he's done has been wise, kingly maneuvers. I don't think he's made a tactical mistake yet as king in the North. I mean, he's been king in the North for 3 episodes at most, but he hasn't made an error yet, an error in judgment or tactical error, I don't think. So he's being honest with his lords, as mad as it may sound to them, but the Northmen believe it, and they follow him blindly until Jon tells them that he has to travel south to meet with Daenerys, the Mother of Dragons, who is invading the south with foreign savage armies and dragons, and then they all voice their displeasure and they refuse to budge on it. And maybe it has more to do with the danger that Jon is putting himself in, and that they may lose a king in the North who they really believe in. But I find it interesting that Jon traveling to meet with Daenerys Targaryen, who could very easily be a threat to them anyway, him traveling to meet with her and discuss a future with her, that gets them so riled up. But he tells them about White Walkers and an army of the undead crossing the wall, which has never been crossed, which has never been broken, and they just believe that blindly. What's up with that? Why is it that the thought of him meeting with Daenerys, they don't know what she'll be like, so you have the fear of the unknown, but why does that get them so bent out of shape, whereas them foregoing a final harvest, knowing that a long winter is coming, knowing that so many of their young men died following Robin to war, but they don't worry about that. They keep helping Jon prepare for this coming battle of Armageddon.
Do you think it's because they feel, okay, well, if this is true and it is for the better good, to go down south to meet with a Targaryen girl, it's going to be, once again, another Stark going with the Targaryen, and we all know what happened the last couple of times that's happened.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with that, for sure. But if they can trust Jon about the White Walkers, why can't they trust him that he's doing the right thing now with Daenerys?
I think you said it off air, are they afraid that Jon's going to give up the title of King of the North?
And then they go back to square one again. Whereas right now they have a lot of northern pride. Listen, they love Jon, man. They love Jon. Because he came to them, asked them for help. They basically all said no to him. And then he went and he fucking won the North back anyway. And then he forgave them all. Maybe that's what it is. They're not so much mad at Jon. They just don't want to lose Jon. And they're worried that they lose Jon if he goes south. Mm-hmm. They declared Robb the king in the North, but that was in the heat of battle, and everybody was declaring themselves a king at that point in time. Robb proved to be a pretty bad king. Cersei's telling her southern lords a tall tale, dressing up her own story. Fake news, almost. Confirmed Dany has landed at Dragonstone, and she does have dragons, and she does have Unsullied, and she does have Dothraki. These are all fact, and most everyone in Westeros is aware of it. But the Southern Lords, they seem more concerned with what will happen if they don't respond to Cersei's command to come to King's Landing than they are concerned that the last scion of House Targaryen is invading Westeros with all of these foreigners. They come to see Cersei and listen to her talking, but no matter what she says, they're not fazed. They don't know what Dany's intentions are, and they only have what Cersei tells them to go off of. Cersei's embellishing the truth. If you think about it, it's still a more reasonable, it's a more believable truth than Jon Snow's warning about the White Walkers. Yet the Southern Lords, they're not inspired by this threat that Cersei's trying to sell them. Cersei's offering them a real enemy that none of them can doubt the existence of. But it's not a story that they're believing in. They're just accepting that Cersei's saying this because she needs their help. They see through all of it. They know it's all a big show. They know Cersei has an ulterior motive, but they don't even seem like they're really interested in what that ulterior motive is. They've been waiting to be summoned to King's Landing. They grudgingly go to King's Landing, and they keep their mouths shut the entire time. They listen to her plea with a grain of salt. They'll agree to it because they have to, because she's the queen. But they're not going to be inspired by her, and they're not really even going to be scared of Daenerys. And I'm sure if the tide of battle turns against them, they're going to either drop their swords and run, or they're going to surrender and tell Dany that they'll fight for her. Even though Cersei's threat is real, and Jon, we know Jon's is real, but how do you take that realistic if you haven't seen it? And how do you take that as your main threat if winter's coming and you don't have any food for your people? And you have like the shortest amount of time to prepare all this. But instead you're preparing for an attack from White Walkers. You see how crazy it sounds? And I'm just talking about from the Lord's point of view. It's like Southern politics versus Northern loyalty. And it's a perfect example of each. Southern cunning, or what passes as being cunning and conniving in the South, versus Northern bravery. Because Cersei is cunning, and she thinks she's being cunning here. Jon Snow, he knows he's not cunning. That dude's just brave. He's courageous. And that's what inspires the Northern lords. So he could tell them that Santa Claus is coming with like a billion reindeer to take over Westeros, and they'll be like, all right, what do we need to do to stop Santa Claus, Jon? He won their heart. He inspired them. Cersei could have a letter from Daenerys saying, I'm going to come to King's Landing and kill you, and then I'm going to go and kill Randall Tarly and then this lord, and name every single lord in the room. Could be signed Daenerys and every one of her allies. But those southern lords will be like, I'm still only here because I know that Cersei will do something fucking crazy if I don't come here. Daenerys seems like she's pretty scary, but you're fucking crazy. You've killed your allies. Burn them alive. Let your son jump out a window. So, yeah, when you call, I'll come. I'll fight for you, but I don't like you. I don't believe in you.
It's like, ever see Naked Gun?
Yeah.
When Leslie Nielsen at the end there, you know, he's calling the guy safe because he doesn't want the out.
Mm-hmm.
And all the umpires are arguing with him. And then it's like he just takes the gun out and they're like, no. You're in. You're on the boss. You're on the boss.
Yes. And then he starts calling like he's like a total homer, calling like, you know.
That's one of those funniest scenes in that movie.
Oh my God,
dude. It's a pop-up to the catcher. He has like 10 balls he throws up in the air. Hits the catcher down. The catcher takes up all but one of them, completely gets the guy runner out at the home plate, which by the way is a foul ball. The runner couldn't even go to home plate. Tags him out like 9 to 10 balls. And he's like, safe.
Leslie Nielsen died? Is he dead?
Yeah.
Nah.
These movies got really dumb after a while, but...
Oh, yeah.
That's Airplane and Naked Gun were just classics.
I like the second Naked Gun, too. The third one I remember being kind of... Yeah. All right, number 6. The misuse of direwolves in Game of Thrones.
God, I was waiting for this one.
What do you think? Is this a budgetary decision? Or is it a deliberate decision?
How can it be budgetary?
At this point, how can it be budgetary? You can make that argument season 2, 3, maybe even season 4. But how could it possibly be budgetary to not include the direwolves?
Especially right now, you only have two of them. And one of them you just showed, and you don't even have to show her again, you don't really need to. But the other one you need to show. I'm sorry, but you need to show Ghost.
You have to. At least with Summer, we saw his death. So there's some kind of closure. I don't like it, but at least he died protecting Bran. Even though I feel like that relationship between Bran and Summer was missed. The whole point of it was missed and somewhat betrayed. But at least they gave closure to it. Mm-hmm. What purpose do these direwolves serve in Game of Thrones? And what purpose will Ghost and Nymeria in particular serve as the series ends? Let's just talk about the other direwolves for a second. Lady was killed by Ned.
Thank you, Sansa.
Right. But he felt it was a better fate for the direwolf than for one of the Lannisters to chop its head off, keep it as a prize, allow Cersei to enjoy it. He realized that he had to. It was the king's command, and he had to kill the direwolf. He who passes the sentence should swing the sword, though. You know, and Robert wasn't going to do that. Robert was like, are you kidding me? But Ned feels it's his duty then to kill the direwolf. Lady seems like she knows her fate, no? It seemed to me like Lady was nice and calm when Ned came up, and...
I think she was scared. I think she was... At that point, she was so a pup, pretty much. So.
Yeah. That was a very, very sad scene. Grey Wind. Grey Wind actually helps Robb win his crown. He helps him win a lot of battles. Those rumors that Robb rides into battle on the back of a direwolf, who became synonymous for Rob. He's killed in the Red Wedding while locked up in a kennel. He was trying to get out of that kennel, right? He was aggressive. He was trying to get out. He was trying to go out fighting.
The show was a key. The books are a little bit different, but he was trying to jump and get out.
In the books, it's the Knight of Seashells that actually cuts him loose. The Frey soldiers toss some nets on him, and the Knight of Seashells, who is Jane Westerling's older brother or younger brother, I think it's her older brother, who's a pretty good fighter, pretty good knight. He has the nickname the Knight of Seashells. That's the sigil for the Westerlings, was the seashells. He gets hit with a couple arrows, but he cuts Ghost free, and then he dives. He cuts Grey Wind free, and then he dives into the trident, green fork, whatever fork it is that he dove into. You never hear from the Knight of Seashells again. You don't know if he's alive or dead. But Grey Wind then gets to fight some more until he's just overtaken. Lady is a lot like Sansa, especially at that point in time, and Grey Wind's a lot like Rob, especially at that point in time. Do you agree or disagree?
Agree. Completely agree.
Shaggy Dog. We don't know his fate in A Song of Ice and Fire, but he's killed by the Umbers after Rob's failed war campaign. So after Rob's dead, Great John Umber is said to die at the Red Wedding also in Game of Thrones. So Small John Umber, his son and heir, he takes over as Lord of the Last Hearth, which was one of the most loyal of Winterfell's bannermen, where Shaggy Dog, Rickon, and Osha travel to remain safe. And I don't know how long they were there, but they had to have been there for a little while. Because the last time we see Rickon before season 6 is season...
Was it 4?
You might be right. It might be 4.
I think he was around 4.
No, it's 3, dude. It's 3. It's 3.
Because season 3. Yeah, season 3. Because that was the Red Wedding episode.
Yep.
When Bran seen had hoped that John's there, that near Bran with the wildlings. And then Bran says, you have to leave.
It was important for Rickon and Bran to split up, because they're both heirs to Winterfell. You keep them together, you lessen the Starks' chance of taking Winterfell back one day. You split them up, you have a better chance. So Rickon, Osha, Shaggy Dog, they head for the Last Hearth, thinking they'll be safe there. And they're not. Once the Great John's dead, the Small John realizes that the Boltons are the power in the North. He makes his own power play. And he uses the coin that fell into his lap to earn himself a spot at the table, so to speak. And he brings Rickon, Shaggy Dog, and Osha to Ramsay Snow. He blames his father's death on the Starks, on Rob, and he offers up Rickon as a token of loyalty. Mm-hmm. At the same time, betraying his father, the Great John, betraying all of his Umber forebears, and betraying his leal lord and his king, even though Rob is dead. And he offers Shaggy Dog's head as proof that Rickon is actually Rickon.
Right.
But in life, Shaggy Dog was a lot like Rickon. Just wild, untamed, a lot of energy, and hard to control. Angry. They had the same personalities. Summer. He accompanied Bran, Meera, and Jojen, and Hodor to find the Three-Eyed Raven. And he was a big reason that they got her. Especially that final battle when they reached the cave. And Bran learned a lot about his warging abilities using Summer. You can make the case that Ghost and Jon is the closest Stark-Direwolf relationship. But you can make an argument that Bran and Summer was also, no? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely at least the second strongest. The connection is so powerful because of the warging that Bran practices on him and keeps getting better at. But Summer gets killed by, not by White Walker, but I think by undead wights kill him. He sacrifices himself so Bran can live and escape. Almost like Summer sees that there's a bigger picture for Bran. I don't know that Summer's personality was so much like Bran's, because honestly, I don't even know what the fuck Bran's personality is. When he was a kid, he used to like to climb, right. But now he's just like a freakishly tall, weird-looking dude. And it sucks, because his character could be so much better. So those are the dead direwolves. Ghost, in Game of Thrones, has very little to do with Jon's resurrection, it seems. Present when Jon wakes, and nobody else's. But we haven't seen, he's not even spoken of since that episode. And Nymeria was chased off by Arya for her own protection. But we haven't seen her. I think that was the King's Road, right? That was season 1, episode 2. We haven't seen her since then. I might be wrong, but it's right around there.
It's episode 2 or 3.
Yeah.
It's episode 2.
And it's the same episode that Lady dies. Catelyn said that she thought that as long as there was a direwolf, her children would be protected. It's true to a certain degree that the direwolves try to protect them. And Catelyn didn't know the full story with Bran and Rickon. She just assumed they were dead. But they weren't. Summer and Shaggy Dog would not let them be killed, especially by Theon and the 18 guys he had. In Song of Ice and Fire, the direwolves, and quite a few characters say this, that the direwolves are the way to tell that a Stark is a Stark. Like, the direwolves are proof that Bran is who he says he is, or Rickon is who he says he is. The warging is such a key part of A Song of Ice and Fire, and the direwolves are such a key part of the warging. And it seems like, even with Sansa, that there's proof of, maybe not so much Rob, but it seems like there's proof of every Stark kid warging into their direwolf. Arya for sure, Bran for sure, Jon for sure. You know, the way Rob says, the way he says Grey Wind when he's killed, it seems like he has some experience warging. And Sansa has a dream about Lady one time where it seems like she's one with Lady. Rickon, we don't know, but we can only assume. But it's such an important part of A Song of Ice and Fire, and it's just completely ignored in Game of Thrones. It's implied in A Song of Ice and Fire that it was fate for the Stark kids to find the direwolves. So how is this so unimportant that it's not included in Game of Thrones?
I can't defend them on it. I just see no reason. Even the times they have shown ghosts, he's saving Samwell, right, you know, more than saving John. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I can't defend them at all. A lot of things I can defend them with.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is just one of those things that I can't defend them with.
It seems like when they do have a direwolf scene, it's like it's a forced scene. They don't even do it anymore. But when they did, it was, they wrote a scene just to get the direwolf in. They're like, well, we should include Ghost. All right, we'll have him save Sam again. It's like they were scared to explore that relationship between the Starks, between Jon Snow, and their direwolf. And I don't understand why. I don't understand what is so challenging about that. Using real dog actors? Like, okay, you have a dragon now. You have a gigantic dragon that costs a lot of money. There's no way that the direwolf costs as much as the dragon. You don't need him in every episode, but you need those key direwolf moments. And they just totally fucking shit the bed on it. Mm-hmm. Completely shit the bed on it. To the point where I'd have to say the best portrayal of these direwolves was probably Lady and Nymeria and Summer, because they at least seemed like they had a full arc. You know what I mean? Like, Lady had a beginning and an end. Nymeria hasn't been in it because she had to run away, and now she's showing up again, and I'm sure they'll fuck it up. And Summer, he was with Bran the whole time, and he died protecting Bran. So that was the best job they did with the direwolves. But Ghost completely, completely shit the bed. Grey Wind, they should have shown him in battle more. It's so disheartening because it's such an important part of who these kids are and how they grow up. Every single one of these Starks is in a difficult fucking situation, and for the most part, all alone, with the exception of Rob. But they're on a lonely journey where they learn about themselves and have to reach a goal that's vital to their family, to Winterfell, to their house, sometimes to the realm. And their direwolves are in some ways the only companion they have, and it keeps them going. It's just completely disregarded. I need to know why. I need to know how they justify that.
I can't come up with any reasons. I don't know why. Past episode was, a scene was cut with Ghost and John in it.
You said Brian Cogwin talked about that?
Yeah. He was like the third guy in charge. He's like, you know, D&D died in a car accident tomorrow. Brian Cogwin's going to be taking over the show.
I think you do an all right job with it.
He was the guy who wanted the door in there, supposedly, so I don't know. Oh.
Well, I'm sure he wanted to do it right.
But supposedly, they filled the scene with John and Ghost, as they should have done. You know, like, he's leaving Winterfell. You know, he's leaving Winterfell. Ghost, you're going to be with Sansa. And D&D cut it.
So it would have been for Dragonstone, and it would have just been like, I'm leaving for Winterfell.
No, Stormborn.
Stormborn. He said, I'm going to leave for Winterfell. You stay with Sansa. Fine. Acknowledge that Ghost is still alive. And acknowledge the reason why he won't be around John. If I was John, I would totally bring Ghost with me to Dragonstone. Are you kidding me? You bring Ghost everywhere, dude. He's part of you. He's part of your strength. Through the years, I've gotten frustrated at Benioff and Weiss. At Game of Thrones as an adaptation, I've got frustrated at quite a few things. Upon a rewatch, upon sitting with these things, when all is said and done, I'm okay with them. And I've learned that really it's just George Martin that I'm angry with. The only thing that I hold against Benioff and Weiss, I'm disappointed in them. I'm angry at them because I don't think that they tried very hard. And until I hear them speak on it directly, it's the direwolves that they royally fucked up. They could have easily done a better job. And it just seems like they didn't care. For guys that are so passionate about this material that they spent the last decade of their life creating this TV show, come on, how do you miss that? You read the books. How do you not include the direwolves?
Especially when the first chapter mentioned them. You know, it's not like it was a...
And I'm sure that, you know, there's things they could do to make up for it in the back part of season 7, season 6. They can make an effort to make up for it, but it's just so far gone at this point. If they don't include Ghost ever again, I wouldn't be surprised.
I just have to think the fact that he's still alive, that he has to have some sort of importance. somewhere.
Well, he definitely does, but just I don't know if it's in Game of Thrones. Usually I give Benioff and Weiss the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I haven't always, but my thing now is always give them the benefit of the doubt, but I don't with the direwolves. They've had plenty of opportunity to do the right thing, or even to not include them, but explain it. Why? It's like they just, maybe they'll forget about the direwolves. Don't worry about the audience. And you know what? For the most part, they're right, because I don't see that many people talking about the direwolves and where they are and how royally fucked up a job Benioff and Weiss have done with them. The seven-pointed star. Topic number seven. This final scene, this final sequence was the... It wasn't the nuts and bolts of this episode. Without this scene, you said this in the instant review, without this scene, we still would have had a phenomenal episode of Game of Thrones. Do you still believe that?
Yes.
And really, that's what a good battle should do in Game of Thrones. A good battle shouldn't make or break the episode. It should always be the characters and what's going on that makes or breaks an episode. It should be the battles that's the reward. The battles that, like, is a culmination of the drama that's occurring on screen. I don't know if that's exactly the case with this Greyjoy versus Greyjoy naval battle, but this has been the destination for Yara, Theon, and Euron since Euron threw Baelon off the bridge. And it's not over yet for everyone involved, but I don't have a good feeling about Yara after this battle. The scene, the Greyjoy versus Greyjoy naval battle. And I was thinking about why does this battle work so well? What are the elements leading into the battle? We start it with a calm character-building moment. Though Yara and Ilaria Sand, it seems like we're getting their, like, the selfish, undesirable characteristics that both characters have. It's almost like predictable. We've seen this side of both of them before. I don't particularly like it. I was just like, Jesus. Not uncomfortable, but I wasn't interested in it. It seemed like, all right, here we go, another gratuitous sex scene, which is pretty much par for the course. I feel like I've seen a Game of Thrones scene like this like a billion times. But I think that they did that to establish a sense of calm. Everything's okay. Everything's
all of a sudden, you know, thrusting of ships.
The vessel just starts to shake and interrupts the calm. The vibe almost where, like, I'm starting to not pay attention to the episode. Because, like I said, I've seen this shit like a billion fucking times. I don't care who's hooking up. I've seen hookups on Game of Thrones so many times. I don't give a crap who hooks up. It's not engaging at this point. And yeah, I think they did that on purpose. The vessel shakes and it interrupts everything going on. And you get this look on Yara's face. And it's like, you know that she knows it's her uncle. Like, she knows it. But I think Yara has known that Euron would find her. And I think Yara felt like that would be her fate. Like, she would eventually succumb to her uncle. She's not someone who's going to run from battle. But she has this look on her face in the quarters below, almost like defeated. Do you agree, or do you think I'm kind of reading too much into it?
That she was defeated?
She almost had like she knew it was her uncle, that she was scared because it was her uncle.
I think she's probably just more like scared that she probably knows she, you know, I can't take him in a battle scene, you know, like, especially with him getting the upper hand, like, right away, like, you know, like right off the bat, he had upper hand. You know, if she would have came and surprised him, maybe it's a different outcome.
That's why they ran in the first place. Euron had the numbers on them, and Euron would just view them as a threat to his Seastone chair and kill them. So they had to run. They both know their uncle, and he's a fucking psycho, and he would never stop chasing them. Yara tells Ilaria Sand to stay put. In telling Ilaria Sand to stay put, it makes her prize. Like, the queen in the situation. They gotta protect the queen, protect the prize. Euron's boarding, he wants the prize. But that's what they establish with Ilaria staying down below. Not to mention the romantic gesture that Yara's making by going to fight to keep her safe. After they almost share this intimate moment, which was totally not interesting, not engaging, like I said, but there's a bit of a romantic gesture to it also. And when we get outside to the deck, that fucking mist that's surrounding the fleet, and you see Euron's fleet like creeping in from the mist, almost like they're ghosts. They just appear suddenly. And it's kind of poetic. I mean, if you look at it this way, it's poetic that the fate Yara was running away from, it finds her the moment her guard is down. She was with Daenerys and Meereen, and then at Dragonstone, safety numbers. The moment she has a mission on her own to help Daenerys' cause, the moment she's in charge, the moment she lets her guard down is when Euron shows up. And I was thinking about Yara Greyjoy in Game of Thrones, and I never put much... The actress's name is Gemma Whelan, but her character while Baelon was king and she was his heir versus her character at the King's Moot, where she was trying to be a queen... versus her character now on the run. And I feel like they're all different characters. Like, while Baylan was alive, it was important to her to rescue Theon from Ramsay. When her father was murdered, she knew it was Euron right away. And she wanted justice for her father up until the moment that Euron won the Kingsmoot. And then when she was running away, she was doing all this drinking and whoring at all these ports with no plan of what to do next. So it's like she had all these ideals, this sense of justice, and it just all went to shit once Euron became king and she had to go and run. And it's a good thing Theon was with her because he kind of kept her balanced. Her own narrative is coming to a head with this battle. So the plank falls, and it's like that drawbridge dropping slowly, and it's gaining speed, and I love this shot. It's so violent, and it's so, like, explosive that plank falls and smashes one of her men. And then you get Euron fucking howling and laughing, and he's just a fucking madman. Pilu Asbayek. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But again...
At least you attempt. I can't even attempt that name.
I mean, I could do Pilu. I don't know the last name, but... Dude, his performance was even better than last week. It's fucking nuts, bro. Screaming, yelling, like, maniacally as he enters the fray. And he literally leads his men onto the enemy ship. And we know most lords and generals, they lead from the back. It doesn't happen in Game of Thrones. Stannis at the Blackwater. Stannis at Winterfell. Robb's always on the front line. Jaime. Even Tywin at the Blackwater. He was running people down. And that's not how lords are supposed to go to battle, because they can easily be killed. So I don't believe it when Stannis is killing all these dudes and nothing's happening to him. It's not believable to me. But Euron being on the front line, literally being the first man to jump on board, I believe that. That's his character.
He says shit like that. He doesn't care.
No, he doesn't care. He's a fucking madman, bro. He loves it. Watching that scene again, he's forged with Victarion Greyjoy, because everything in that battle, like the fighting, the axe, the fighting ability, the courage, that's all Victarion. And then the madness is Euron. Like, Victarion is the brawn and Euron is the brains. Tide of battle. How is edited together? It follows Euron, Yara, mainly. Then it follows Theon and the Sand Snakes. Yara keeps fighting and she's fighting well, but she'll stop fighting and she'll look at her fleet burning, or she'll stop and she'll look at Euron. And on her face, it seems like she knows what her fate is and she's resigned to it. She's going to keep on fighting, but she knows how this is going to end. And she sees the two sand snakes up there. I don't know which sand snake is which, but she tells us the two sand snakes on deck to go and protect their mother, go and protect the prize. And they're like, all right, yeah, we'll get the fuck out of here and do that. It kind of reestablishes Ilaria's role in this battle as the prize, what they're battling over. But Euron kills the two sand snakes. What did you say? How did you put it? The way he killed them?
Oh, it's fitting. With their own weapons.
He killed them the way that they would have killed anybody. Like, that's the way they kill people with their weapons, and that's the way he killed them. And it's almost kind of mocking. It's like mocking them in a sense. Mm-hmm. But he kills the two sand snakes, and doing that, he raises the stakes of the battle then. So then the battle goes to another level, and it's more intense because you know that main characters can die in this battle now. And we have two deaths in this battle. Yara and Theon keep on fighting. They're fighting well, but there's just this sense of dread and foreboding and imminent defeat as they're fighting, because you see their fleet being destroyed, their men being killed, Euron just laughing maniacally, totally enjoying this, and Yara is having trouble remaining engaged in the battle. And what we know of her characters, she loves this stuff. She lives for it. Yara seems like she's fighting scared in this battle. She said in the past that dying in battle is a good enough death. That reality is now facing her, and it's like she's having second thoughts. And she has to feel foolish for letting her guard down, for not paying attention, for getting caught unprepared, having like scout ships looking for Euron, knowing that Euron is out there looking for her. She knew he was out there. Euron's men, they descend into the holdings where Ilaria and her and the last Sand Snake are. Well, the Sand Snake tries to defend Ilaria, but it's unsuccessful. She doesn't die.
They're part of the gift.
Yeah, well, I knew Ilaria wouldn't, but I didn't know if that last Sand Snake was going to. As the prize is won by Euron, Yara and Euron, the tide of battle brings them together. You know, I would have thought that knowing Yara, that she would have sought out Euron immediately. She would have went for him immediately, as soon as he boarded the boat. But it's like she was like trying to fight around and almost like fight away from him, it looked like. Euron's got wounds from the Sand Snakes, so he's not fighting at 100%. He's a little bit slower than the beginning of the battle, but he still like mocks Yara and he looks like he's on fire, bro. You know what I mean? Like he's like electric. He says like, come give your uncle a kiss or something like that. And just the way he says the line, like Yara's just like fucking disgusted. Theon's fighting well. which is a surprise with his missing appendages. It's kind of like a throwback to when he was fighting with Rob in the Whispering Wood. Forget that Theon was a really good fighter because all the shit he's been through. It's a close battle between Euron and Yara, but Euron defeats her. He captures her. He's got his axe against her neck. And then he calls out to Euron. And what is he? He's like, little Theon, my cockless nephew. He says something like that, but he challenges Theon to come and save his sister. You know, Theon just totally reverts. It's like he sees Ramsay Snow again.
Right. In Euron's mockery. What he was seeing was he saw some of the people getting their tongues cut out. So that kind of like, oh, so I'm going to be weak again. Nope. Out of here.
Like, I'll die before I go back to that. I don't know. I mean, do you think that Euron would have killed Theon also? I think that Yara is more valuable to him because he can marry her.
He would torture both of them.
Yeah. Well, Theon is technically, by Westerosi law, Theon is heir to the Iron Islands. So they're both threats to him in a sense. But Euron's mocking him and seeing people get their tongues taken out, thought of being captured in the cell again, seeing his sister helpless and almost looking at her like half pleading him to come save her. I thought half like kind of telling him to get out of there. And I still don't know which it was. But he begins to twitch. And you know that like he's just turning back into Reek. Yeah, it's funny, but it's sad too. But like he's just twitching. And he reverts completely. He negates all his growth over the last two seasons. And again, Gemma Whalen's performance as Yara, I think she looked as though she expected Theon to flee. And I think she also looked as though she was really disappointed in Theon for fleeing. But she could see it too. She saw him turn back into Reek and she knew Reek isn't going to help her. Theon probably could not defeat Euron. So maybe it is better that he flees to inform the queen. But like, how is he going to survive the water? Like, you know what I mean? Like they're in the middle of the ocean. And we get the final shot of the two sand snakes hanging from the prow of the ship, which is a pretty powerful shot. My wife Carolyn thought it was Yara at first. It was the sand snakes, and it was a really, really powerful ending to the episode. I think this is the official breakout of Euron Greyjoy as a major player in Game of Thrones. I think people started taking him real serious last week. I know I did, but this week he's a player. He's not Ramsay Bolton level yet. I'm not saying that, but this is his breakout. This is proof of his claim he made to Cersei to be the greatest captain in Westeros, or whatever the fuck he said. It's proof of the strength of the Iron Fleet. In this battle, Euron becomes frightening. He becomes a frightening character without some of the main A Song of Ice and Fire features that make him frightening. So, for example, like the Crow's Eye, like his eye patch, his Valyrian steel armor. It's okay, though.
The Crow's Eye, and at least the eye patch, maybe you can say maybe would look too Pirates of the Caribbean.
Barry Dondarrion has the eye patch, so maybe we think if people get confused. I don't know.
Could at least say, listen, brother, remember I'm the Crow's Eye. I bring the storm.
The first storm and the last. So the prize is lost as far as the battle. Ilaria Sand, Euron will bring her to Cersei and propose an alliance once again. Yara has failed three times now, right? She failed to rescue Theon. She failed to win the Kingsmoot. And now she failed to bring Ilaria to... What was their mission? She was bringing Ilaria Dorne to get men?
Yeah.
Okay. Theon, on the other hand, was building back up to almost a shell of who he was, and he's got to start from the bottom again. And the very definition of hitting bottom is Theon. And I'm sure he'll get out of the water. He'll survive somehow. What does he do? He must go back to Daenerys, I guess. That'd be the first thing he'd do, and say that we got attacked.
It's the only place he can go to.
Ilaria Sand will pay for her sins. You know, we were talking about narrative justice before with Melisandre. Ilaria has a lot of narrative justice coming her way.
They're going to kill the Tyene first in front of her.
Yeah, I would think so.
I would imagine. Let her suffer.
Yeah, Cersei's going to have some fun this week.
Oh, my. Then they haven't been to this one.
Cersei will get her own narrative justice at some point. The more she puts it off, the more she saves herself by doing these horrible things to other people, the worse her narrative justice is going to be. Hence why I believe her fate will be that of the Forsaken chapter, because it's a fucking horrible, horrible fate. And she already had that, the Walk of Shame, which, you know, if you read A Song of Ice and Fire, you're like, all right, you know, the way George writes it, you're like, all right, that's pretty rough. Like, maybe she's even now with the horrible things she's done. But it seems like she goes on to do even worse things. She's got to pay for it. Everybody's got to pay the price. And that's about it. Last week, we end the episode with Dany saying, shall we begin? And she seemed fucking on top of the world with her military strength and the state of Westeros as she lands. The end of season six, you would think that Dany would take Westeros no problem. There's no way that Cersei can stand up to her. You floated the idea at the end of season six that Euron would join Cersei. And it made sense. That'll make her a little bit stronger, but she's still not a match for Daenerys. But after this battle, you lose the Greyjoy fleet and you lose House Martell. It's a big fucking blow, man. And you know what? Thought of Jon Snow coming to Dragonstone and her making him bend the knee? It seems like she needs him as an ally a lot more than she did when she wrote that letter.
Definitely. It's way too short for me to really rank. It did its duty. Like, it is what it's supposed to be. I can't actually think, oh, wow, it's a great battle.
Were you entertained? Was there anything about it that you would have changed?
Just wish it was longer.
I mean, you can't make a full episode out of it, but...
No.
Yeah, you could have raised the stakes, and you definitely could have made it longer. But like I said, I think it's just a little taste of what kind of battles we'll be getting. And I think we'll be getting at least a battle like that. Probably, I would think, every episode for the rest of this season. Lord of Lightning round. And it's just some stuff that we didn't cover. Qyburn's weapon against the dragons. Is this a fail? Or do you think it's something that can work?
It could work. It was foreshadowing what the Night King is going to do in episode 6.
Okay. Grey Worm and Missandei. Convince me.
Time.
Yeah. So this is purely...
Grey Worm's dead. If Grey Worm doesn't die this Sunday, he's dying the following Sunday.
And I don't even care. You know what I mean? I
don't care either.
I mean, you asked me if I like the guy. Yeah, I like the guy. He seems like a nice kid, but, you know, there's a lot more going on. I don't need... Missandei's a smoke show, but I don't need that. It's Pillman time or... Just HBO's quota for gratuitous sex. Samwell Tarly, is he the narrator for this story? Is that where they're going?
My thing is he's narrating the story while he's also in the story.
I think they say it's going to be like a Bilbo Baggins situation where he goes back and he writes, you know, as an older man, maybe he writes A Song of Ice and Fire or a Game of Thrones or whatever the fuck. There and Back Again too. I don't know if I buy into it. I don't think I have enough information yet to make the call, but... It's been growing again, this theory. It started last season when you saw the Citadel. And then there was that scene with Jim Broadbent where he talks about his book about Robert's Rebellion and Sam says the name isn't poetic enough. Yeah, it's growing again.
More about him doing the story anyways. I just don't get what's the big deal then if he's...
It's possible, it's true, but like, what, you know, so what? Once the story's over, that's maybe something that will interest me. I think I know your answer to this. Samwell Tarly and Jorah Mormont. Is the Jorah Mormont connection between the two too subtle?
More should have made of it.
Sansa is the Stark in Winterfell.
She was, oh my gosh, you know what, just kill her, please.
So this is not a good choice by Jon. Who else could have been left in charge with him going?
Well, there's really no one else, but just felt like she's like arguing and all of a sudden, like, you know, you're in charge. She's like all happy and all.
It's like, oh, okay. Well, good idea then.
Good, go to Dragonstone.
Yeah, I support you now. Follow-up question. With everything that's happened throughout this season, throughout the series, is a Stark in Winterfell even a necessary thing anymore? Could he have left Tormund in charge? Bronn Jean Royce.
He had to leave Sansa there.
Yeah.
I think there's no one else he could have. But then, you know, next week we're going to get the Stark's going to come there, so.
That'll be nice. Littlefinger. I'm not going to ask you what Littlefinger's play is, but do you think he's just freewheeling right now, or do you think he has a plan formulated and he's being able to follow it?
He's going to get a plan formulating, but it's not going to work.
Well, I believe he will, but do you think he has it right now, or do you think he's just kind of like probing for weakness and trying to figure out a plan?
Probing.
Okay. All right. The Lord of Lightning round. Tyrion and Arya only learned that Jon Snow is king in the North in this episode. Is there a narrative reason for this, or do you think it was just done because their reactions makes good television?
Just storytelling. Just That was when the time is the story to come.
And it was good television. It's good to see them both learning that. How can Tyrion possibly work with Ilaria Sand knowing that she poisoned Myrcella? I didn't even think of it until he mentioned something. And then, it's like, I don't know, like how Myrcella was innocent. So how could he possibly work with her?
I just don't know. There's no answer really for it.
I guess loyalty to his queen is the only answer.
Yeah, that's the only one.
Olenna Tyrell, should another Tyrell have been cast to help her fight open rebellion against the throne? Like, I can't, like, she's the only Terrell that we know, so she's going to be in every scene. Do you think another Terrell should have been cast?
No, because it's just, you'd be making someone up at this point, right?
Yeah, unless you want to, like, you know, backtrack and say that there is a Willis Terrell or a whatever the fuck the other Terrell's son was. Or, you know, use one of those girls that was at court with Marjorie from Feast for Crows, one of her cousins. Mm-hmm. You know, there's characters they could have found and used. I think it would have helped if they did. At the same time, no need to introduce any more characters than we need to. Last two. Without spoiling, do you think Randall Tarley joins Jaime as his general?
Cersei needs more people in the alley, so it makes sense that that's kind of like an Umber and Karstar thing going with the Boltons.
Last question. Does Randall Tarley fucking realize that Heartsbane is gone? And how does he not know it's Sam? And how does he not just go to the Citadel to take the fucking sword back?
He has to know it's gone by now. How can I know it's not gone? Like, if someone took one claw off my finger badly, I'd freaking know.
Right, but wouldn't you do something about it? Like, wouldn't you, if you knew who it was? Like, he's got to know it's Sam. He's got to. It don't matter.
Plot hole. D&D plot hole.
Next week, the Queen's Justice. What are you expecting?
Bran's coming back to Winterfell. She's just going to miss Jon.
But you think Bran and Arya both show up at Winterfell same week? Very nice.
I'm gonna as soon as we see some flashbacks, we see this scene with Sansa is next week.
What scene with Sansa?
And Bran's in the background. We're going to see some flashbacks.
Okay, what kind of flashbacks are you thinking? Like a Rhaegar Lyanna flashback? Or
possible some little fair flashbacks that maybe Bran starts showing her what he was doing. I'm going to think that there's also some stuff at the Citadel that we're going to find out.
That Sam's going to learn about
Rhaegar Lyanna.
Okay, interesting. Very, very cool. How about any action, any battles?
Well, I think you're going to start the battle up. There's going to be, I would imagine there's going to be one of the battles made for Khashoggi the Rock might be started up.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, then they sent the armies off to two spots last week. So we already saw what happened with one of them.
Right.
And now it's the Khashoggi the Rock. Euron's going to come back with a gift.
Well, you said episode 4 is the spoils of war. So maybe we don't get Euron next week, especially if we're going to have...
No, they showed in the highlights.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Yeah. Big thing is going to be is John and Danny are going to meet for the first time ever.
That seems like it will be the key scene because that's going to be most of Game of Thrones going forward. All right. Good stuff, man. Good stuff. All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. We totally appreciate it. We got a lot of new listeners in the last couple of weeks. So feel free to tell friends and family members about our show, coworkers, classmates, whoever you think would be interested in The Princes That Were Promised. There are billions and billions of Game of Thrones podcasts out there, but we are the best. We're coming at you twice a week, every week, while the show airs. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/ThePromisedPrinces. You can find us on Twitter, @PrincesPromised. You can find us on Tumblr, theprincesthatwerepromised.tumblr.com. You can read our writings at WordPress, theprincesthatwerepromised.wordpress.com. And, of course, visit our homepage. That's thepromisedprinces.actionpackedpodcasts.com. Please, please take a couple minutes and leave a review. It helps other listeners find us. It's the only way for iTunes to start promoting us. We would very, very, very much appreciate it if you leave a review. We'll talk to you guys next week with our instant review of The Queen's Justice. We'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening. John, as always, it's been a pleasure. Have a good night. Bum, 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 bum. Ba 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 ba